maybe some fog. Tonight's low 57. Wednesday looks lovely, sunny and 79. This morning, wind from the north at 3, 96% humidity, 66 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we will be exploring a case that absolutely captivated the American public 70 years ago, and yet many Americans still know the name of Alger Hiss and of the trial of the century, which ultimately sent Hiss to prison. And it not only made his name a household name, but also the name of one of his primary accusers, one Richard Milhouse Nixon. The story of all of this is told in very intriguing fashion in a fascinating new book called Alger Hiss Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Nixon Famous. This is written by someone who actually had the opportunity to meet Mr. Hiss some years after these dramatic events had transpired. Joan Brady, a very, very gifted writer, the author of several different novels, and also a very gifted dancer as well. She has written two different works of nonfiction, and this book is the second. And in it, we hear about her personal face-to-face encounters with Mr. Hiss, and then her examination of the events from the late 1940s, which she characterizes as nothing but a crooked frame of a innocent man. Again, the book is Alger Hiss Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Nixon Famous, published by Arcade Publishing. And Joan Brady, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Ahead of us talking about kind of the specific events chronicled in this book, I wonder if you would maybe spell out for our listeners, well, not quite your life story. That's a rather audacious request to make. But beyond what I have just said, what is important for our listeners to know about you and in a sense about your life's journey before we burrow into this specific story?
Well, I suppose it's important that I was a dancer, that I stopped dancing to go to Columbia to study philosophy. I wanted to know what truth was. You're not supposed to laugh, but you can't help. I mean, I really did want to know, and they didn't teach me, I can tell you that. But then I married, and I married a writer, and I just sort of fell into the writing thing. It seemed a natural sort of thing to do, and after my husband died, I finished a novel I had started about my grandfather, and I won a couple of quite important British prize, a major British prize and a major French prize for them, for this novel. And I wrote several other novels after that. I have not won other prizes, but I've been shortlisted for a number. I don't know. Do you need to know more than that?
No, I think that's excellent. And that gives us a sense of kind of your wide-ranging talents and interests, and also tells us something about the circumstances under which you actually got to meet Mr. Hiss. Maybe you could say a word about the man who became your husband, Dexter Masters, what he was, in a sense, all about. That is a name that I think is not going to be all that familiar to too many of our listeners.
He was a writer who did, he had a number of interests. One of them was Consumers Union. He was director of Consumers Union for many years. which, going back to Alger's time, was viewed as a communist front organization, if you can imagine that. And he wrote a novel about the first atomic accident. And he also wrote a book called One World or None, which was he was the editor of that. It was all the major scientists from the Manhattan Project wrote pieces for this, and and it was published as a book, including Einstein. I mean, he was there. And he, see, the thing, I suppose it's important to say that after Alger got out of prison, he didn't have any money, and he'd been stripped of his ability to practice law. So he had to sort of scrounge around. He tried to write a book about his case. The fact is, it was just terribly boring. And so he had to find a way to make a living. And first thing he got to do, he did stand in line a lot for handouts and stuff. But the first thing he did was to sell women's barrettes for hair. And then he got a job with a paper company, Davison Bluth in New York. And he would call people up, and he could make sales that other people could not, because he would open his patter with, "This is Alger Hiss."
Wow.
And people then could go home and say, "Guess who tried to sell me paper clips today?" You see.
And once in a while, somebody would probably make a purchase.
Well, in fact, apparently he sold a lot of stuff. And he tried to, Dexter was one of the people he called. But it turned out that Davison Bluth wasn't big enough to supply their print run. They had quite a few, well, they still do have a very considerable subscription rate amount. So they just couldn't do it. So Dexter invited him to dinner. And that was when I met him.
This was back in 1960. So at the time,
right,
you are 20 years old. You're the man who would
right.
be your husband, I think, was just over 50. And one of
he
the
was.
Things that you do in describing your encounter with Mr. Hiss was also to kind of talk about the dynamics that often were at play in the room, not only for this particular encounter, but when other fairly notable people would come by for various visits and evenings together. I was glad that you described that as much as you did, because I think it really helps bring us into the room when you actually meet Mr. Hiss. Explain what I'm talking about to our listeners,
because
I think it's important to know.
Yeah, okay. The thing about him was that he was quite a high-level diplomat, and the people he was used to being with were Churchill and Roosevelt and, people like that. And he was clearly brilliant at what he did. I mean, and when he came to dinner with me, little ballet dancer, please. He seemed to be treating me in exactly the same way he treated Churchill and Roosevelt. I found it terrifying. But he was interested in what I did. He knew ballet, which almost nobody else did. He knew the ballet. He knew the ballet that was my favorite ballet. It was an extraordinary experience for various reasons. My husband Dexter was just, he wasn't my husband yet, but anyway, he was, I think, really just delighted at the notoriety of Alger at the time, but they got to be quite good friends. And that they were both had similar backgrounds, really.
At that moment when you met him, that is, when you met Alger Hiss, how much did you know about who he was? And what was your sense of whether or not he was guilty of what he had been charged with and ultimately convicted?
Well, I'd heard about him first when I was a child. And we had a civics class in my high school. And there was a picture of him there as America's greatest traitor, which very much intrigued me. He very good looking, being carted away in a paddy wagon. And I think I expected somebody like, I don't know, Al Capone. But this was not what I saw at all. He was tall. He's tall, thin. He really looked like he'd had a hard life, and just virtue shone out of every pore. It was very disappointing.
Right. You're right. At one point, this was no villain out of a fantasy. So, in other words, he proved to be a remarkably ordinary man, and also an intelligent and charming man. And although there were certain moments when you were sort of taken aback, maybe by things he said or things he did, ultimately it was a very positive impression that he made upon you. Explain what your connection ultimately was with him. The number of encounters that you ultimately had
goodness,
with Mr.
I knew him for 30 years. And, you know, so we saw a lot of each other. He was not my favorite person. I think I found this, I'm not quite sure why, because with a lot of people, he was the favorite person. And I have to say, when I started to look into his case, I was really sort of hoping I would find my Al Capone aspect. I mean, it really did. I thought that would be much more interesting. But, and all the time the thing that was remarkable about him, I think that seems to me, as I reflect on it, most remarkable was that he could deal with Winston Churchill, he could deal with kings and queens and things. And then when they sent him to prison, he had a very good time with the prisoners. I mean, he made many friends during his stay in prison. And when he left prison, all the prisoners gathered up and cheered him on. I mean, that's an extraordinary thing.
Right. That brings to mind your intriguing story of the first time that Mr. Hiss, to you, made any specific reference to his past experiences, that is, having been charged with such serious crimes and convicted of them and imprisoned. Explain to our listeners the very first time that he made any sort of direct mention of that at all.
Well, I hadn't expected him to say anything. I thought people like that just sort of kept it to themselves. But it came up because everybody smoked back then. And Dexter offered Alger a cigarette, and he said, no, thank you. And Dexter was quite taken aback because everybody smoked, and said, you don't smoke? And Alger said, no. And I said, why not? And he said, I gave up in prison. And the reason he gave up in prison was that he was allowed only one carton, which would have been, I guess, 20 packs a month or something. And that meant splitting the cigarettes between all the men in his dormitory, which meant about half a cigarette per man per month. And this just caused fights. And he thought it was easier to give up smoking altogether. It was such an extraordinary thing to do. And he talked about it as though, you know, as though it was the sort of thing that might, a Christian diplomat might encounter in a Muslim state. You know, there are certain things you find you don't do. And this is one of the things he found he didn't do. And he found it, you know, it was an extraordinary response to it. And it was completely clean. I mean, there was absolutely no blame to be put on anybody, no recriminations for anybody, nor any shame, whatever.
From that same encounter, there's also an interesting moment. At this point, you are eating dinner together, and there's this moment with a napkin that was also really interesting. And if you don't mind sharing this little moment, it's kind of fun and intriguing. It really, again, makes this encounter between the two of you all the more human.
Well, the thing, Dexter had bought some napkins on Broadway, very sort of pretty flowered napkins. I think they were even hand hemmed and things. They were really quite nice napkins for this dinner. And I put them around on the table. And when it came to putting them into your lap, Alger put his to one side and took out a Kleenex. And I said, oh, I'm terribly sorry. Is there something wrong with it? And he said, no, there's nothing wrong with it at all. It's just that I don't really see why I should use a napkin when a Kleenex does just as well. And what was difficult about this is that I had the feeling he was claiming a moral high ground that I hadn't even thought existed. It was very odd. It just was upsetting. Again, like the, you know, like his treating me as though I were Churchill.
And I think that's part of what makes this the dynamic between the two of you, in a sense, so complicated. In a sense, it's such an unlikely encounter, and yet out of it springs, as you said, something of a friendship, which endured for many years.
And after my husband died, he remained in contact, and he was very warm. In fact, one of the most amazing things is that when people die, other people sort of disappear, you know, particularly if they take a while in this dying thing. And Alger wrote every single day.
Wow.
He was blind by that time. And so he had to guide his, you know, his right hand with the edge of his left hand. And he would write every single day, just a sort of a thought for the day. But it was so kind.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Joan Brady, and we are talking about her book, Alger Hiss Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Nixon Famous. We've been talking up to this point about the initial meeting between Joan Brady at the time, just 20 years old, with Alger Hiss in 1960, and the friendship that ensued from that initial encounter. So all of these years later, you found yourself compelled to do what a couple of other authors have done as well, namely to re-examine the case that that ultimately brought Alger Hiss down in professional ruin and sent him to prison. I'm just curious, first of all, given the fact that at least two different books I can think of have re-examined that case and fairly effectively, clearly you felt like there was more to be said about this and that you were the person to say it. And I think you are. I mean, I'm really glad you wrote this book, but I'm just curious what prompted you to want to write a book about this, particularly so many years after these events ensued.
Well, part of the reason was that I got in legal trouble myself, even was sort of threatened with prison. And the only person I'd ever known who'd been in such a situation was Alger, and he was long dead by that time. So there wasn't any way I could, you know, ask him except to look into his case and find out what they had against him. And I really didn't know even what he'd been accused of. I hadn't realized it was perjury, not espionage. I hadn't realized anything. And so I started, and fortunately, by the time I started working on him, all of the congressional hearings that brought him down were online. So you could just look them up. They're right there. And so I went, and that's what I did. I looked up the hearings. Hearings are kind of boring to read, but you get used to it after a while. And I read this first hearing in which it was perfectly clear that nobody was accusing Alger of anything. I mean, he had actually demanded to appear, which is something people seem to forget. He'd been accused in the newspapers of being a communist. This was something they did. They just accused you by name of being a communist. And so he demanded that he be allowed to clear his name. He'd be allowed to answer these charges. Well, he goes into this hearing. And what's remarkable when you read through it is that nobody will even talk about the charges. He introduces them several times. They're just sort of swept aside. They keep asking him if he's seen this man. And they show him a picture of a man whom he didn't recognize. And then they said they kept wanting names from him. And he tried to give them names. But he could not get them to talk about his charges against him.
And that was the whole reason he wanted to be there, was to answer those charges.
Exactly.
The charge that he had been a communist.
The charge that he had been a communist. It was worse than that he had organized a communist cell within the State Department. I mean, this was really sort of big stuff. And I think during the course of this hearing, they sort of introduce espionage and information passed and things too. But it's they who introduce these things, and they're not followed up at all. It's just left. But you see, the thing is, as he's going home, or I guess the very next morning, the headlines are that Nixon, who turned out to be on this panel, nobody really knew who he was at the time, but he turned out, he releases the fact that he's cracking down on the spy case. This is a spy case? The man, it comes away without an accusation? Everybody seems to think everything is fine, except that the congressional panel is making a mess of things by accusing people without the proper kind of backing.
Hmm. Let's stop here for a second and set the stage. A couple things you say in your book were really, really helpful to me. One of them was to kind of understand politically the climate in America and why there were people on one side of the political aisle who were really anxious to tenaciously and vigorously explore the possibility that the U.S. government was rife with communist sympathizers. And it really hadn't kind of dawned on me that the fact that there had been a Democrat in the White House for such a long time, that in a sense this was wielded as a weapon to help, in a sense, weaken the Democratic Party. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I think the thing is it really was a terrifying time. It wasn't long after Churchill had given his speech about the Iron Curtain, and there was Stalin, who was clearly a crazy man and a very strong expansionist. We ourselves had exploded this bomb over China. We knew he was going to get it. So there was going to be this nuclear Armageddon situation that we have now. You know, it was a terrifying time, and the idea of what communism was, I think, was pretty confused in the American mind. I'm not sure what it is. I have no idea what was really going on in that country. But what was said in America was that they were soul stealers. They'd make you slaves, that you would be unable to do anything from your own volition, and that these people tended to be academics and the well-educated, and they hid their, you know, they hid their secret desires to turn you into a slave under a sort of a very helpful, a Girl Scout type of surface. You know, they were for equal rights. They were for, you know, they were for all these things that right people are for, but they were using them to dupe you. That was the whole, it was the secrecy, the sense of a secret enemy.
Mm, which would be, of course, even more terrifying to the typical American citizen.
Oh, absolutely.
Another thing that I think you spell out well in your book is the brutal reality of the Great Depression and the fact that against such a bleak landscape in which so many people were caught in kind of the vice of utter hopelessness, that in fact it was a time in which many people turned to, in a sense, political and ideological remedies that they might not have ever considered under other circumstances. I guess another way to say it is there were communists in the United States in the 1930s. And I think you really help us understand why some Americans did turn to this out of a sense of desperation.
Well, you had a situation which the U.S. was in terrible trouble with the Depression, whereas Germany, before the war, was doing brilliantly. The Russians were doing brilliantly. I mean, that's the thing that is hard to get. You had these two ideologies that were, I mean, they're GDP was doubling and doubling, whereas ours was halving and halving. And, you know, so you had these two ideologies, and it was a matter of stringing a line between them. I mean, that's what Roosevelt did so brilliantly, was to make a sort of a line that allowed the belief that of the American idea of property along with the Soviet idea of social help, which, I mean, one of the things about the Depression was there wasn't any social security. There wasn't anywhere. These people were reduced to beggars.
Standing in bread lines. I mean, that
standing in bread lines. Absolutely.
That was all there was in terms of the so-called safety net that we talk about today. There was no net at all at that time.
No net at all. And I mean, it really was an extraordinary, whereas you had in Russia and in Germany, both places, you had the safety net.
I think it's also important, understanding kind of the political backdrop and the economic backdrop against which these events begin to sort of ferment. It's also important for us to understand who Alger Hiss was. And the point that that at the time of this initial hearing in 1948, Alger Hiss was already a relatively famous man. Explain his rise to prominence.
Well, he won every prize on earth in Johns Hopkins, and he went to Harvard, and he again was a golden boy. Then he became the clerk to Justice Holmes, who is the guy who coined the phrase clear and present danger. This was the most coveted job for any law student. Then he became the member of a very prominent Boston firm, and then moved to New York, where he became a member of a very famous New York firm. But he had friends in Washington, and he was very pro-Roosevelt. And there was a sense, I think one of the things you kind of have to envy was that people in those years actually thought they could change things. They thought they could make it better. And Alger, for the first time, saw the bread lines. He also saw the inadequacies of the law to protect these people. And Roosevelt was promising exactly what he felt was the right thing to do. So he became a member, he went to Washington, became a member of various committees, and then became also, you know, he rose up, as one does through these things, through the AAA and things like that, to these various alphabet agencies that they had. And he was with Roosevelt at Yalta. You can see him there. Although it's quite funny, they've cut him out of some of the pictures.
Interesting.
It's really amazing, isn't it? But then when he got back, he first thing he did was to organize the United Nations. So he was, in effect, the first Secretary General of the United Nations. And then, after that, he became the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And it was while he was in this position that he was accused.
You write, "Such giddy heights belong in fairy tales. Where could such a man as Alger Hiss not go? No wonder everybody assumed that something as grand as Secretary of State had to come next. Instead came 2 years of headlines like these from the New York Times. Red underground in federal posts alleged by editor." This is one of the first stories in which Alger Hiss is accused of being a communist. Ahead of us plunging then into this story, I want us to talk about one detail from his childhood. And I'm sure this has been written about before, but in all the reading I had done about Alger Hiss, I actually don't remember reading this before. A very tragic moment from early in his childhood involving his father. Can you just say a word about this? And as someone who knew Alger Hiss for so many years, what kind of mark you think this left on him emotionally?
Well, the latter thing I couldn't possibly answer. I don't consider myself terribly good at the internal parts of people's minds, but I can give you I think he was only 2 years old. The family had been very prominent socially. they sort of claimed descendants from a very prominent German family, and they were snooty people, and they had money. I can't remember where the money was from, but they had money, and they went broke, and the only money was to be had at a cotton mill in South Carolina or some such place. And Alger's mother just said no, she wasn't going to do it, she wasn't going to go. So the father said, call the doctor. And he went upstairs and he slit his throat from ear to ear. It's an astonishing thing to have done.
Right. I mean, as I read it in your book, it was one of those moments where I literally stopped and read it again, thinking, surely I had misread that somehow.
Or we, me too. I know what you mean.
We could not, you couldn't possibly have meant that. But there it was. And of course, I eventually found it in other accounts as well. But it's a shocking thing to see. And of course, we are, of course, left to only wonder how that might have, in a sense, lived on in his mind and heart for the rest of his life.
Well, he was very tiny. I mean, 2 is pretty small. And I'm sure he never saw great pools of blood. He probably just was told that Daddy isn't going to be here for a while. I doubt he was ever told until he was grown up, why Daddy had disappeared.
Right.
And they seemed a very close family, and they did seem very supportive of each other. And I think it sounds as though it was a pretty happy childhood. Maybe father was difficult. I don't know.
We're speaking with Joan Brady and talking about her book, Alger Hiss Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Nixon Famous. We've talked about the spectacular way in which Alger Hiss rose to prominence during the 1930s and early 40s. And now it is time to talk about the charge lodged that Alger Hiss not only was a communist, but that he had actually helped to create, in a sense, cells within the U.S. State Department that were sympathetic to communist interests. These charges came from somebody by the name of Whitaker Chambers. Tell us who Mr. Chambers was.
Mr. Chambers was a very interesting man. He was also crazy. But, I mean, he grew up, this strange, strange family he grew up in which the mother kept an axe beneath the bed and the grandmother was running around screaming all the time. He was very bright and very odd. But he was an attention seeker. I mean, even from the time he was at school as a child, he would climb up on buildings and threaten people in order to get attention. And he started writing, even when he was in high school, he started writing spy stories. And he became absolutely obsessed with spies. And this ended up with his going to Columbia. He went to Columbia and wrote a play, not about spies, fortunately, but in which he had Jesus Christ as a homosexual, rather interesting looking one with a red wig. But at the time, this was a terribly shocking thing to do. He loved to shock. That was his major thing in life, was shocking people. And he did it. But he had a lot of trouble because he was so peculiar that he kept wanting to do something that was different, that made real attention to him. He joined the Communist Party and actually didn't have a very good time there. He wanted to do more, and they didn't want him to do very much more. Somebody told me that he ended up stealing $10,000 from them, and so obviously he was scared to death of them. But then he got tired of them. Oh, he used to go around the village when he was in the early 30s, I gather, shouting that he was a Russian spy, and the FBI was following him everywhere. This is not a man who is normal. And when it came, he met Alger because he was doing a story on the munitions committee that Alger was working with at the time. And part of Alger's job was to meet journalists. And so they met there. But so Alger was in his sights, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere around in here, a guy called Krivitsky became the absolute sensation in America because he had been a spy, was a spy, and was writing his memoirs. And Chambers thought, I can do that. And he wrote a manuscript which he signed Carl, all about his spying. And he explained to his friend to whom he showed this manuscript that Carl was his street name. By this time, I've missed out a part. He became an anti-communist. It hardly seems to me to matter which he is, but became as fierce an anti-communist as he was a communist. And he signed this thing Carl, and his friend said, well, look, don't you think it's going to sort of point you out to your Russian enemies to have this signed by you? And so he worked on this manuscript with a couple of people for several years, and they presented it to Adolf Burl, who was an assistant secretary of state or something, who thought the whole thing was crazy. There were no names in it. There were no, you know, there were a few, I think they had names of department people, but there were no spies in it. He didn't accuse anybody of spying of any sort. But this was how he started, and it just got picked up from there. It got bigger and bigger and bigger.
And so at some point, it became, in a sense, his responsibility to begin naming names and give this story teeth. And one of the names is that of Alger Hiss, who of course responds immediately and firmly, and as you said earlier, demanded to appear before this committee to respond to these charges. Let's talk for a moment about the House Un-American Activities Committee, created in, you tell us, back in 1938. I think at that point in time, out of concern for the possibility that there might be people in America with sympathies for the Nazis in Germany. But of course, their sort of focus began to shift then in subsequent years. One of the things you spell out for us is the way in which this committee operated, and the fact that there were certain rules in a typical court of law that were not in place here, that they were not subject to normal court boundaries. Explain just how free their hand was in these hearings.
Well, actually, it was astonishing. And these were not, at least when Alger was going in front of it, these were not intelligent men. These were really quite stupid. And they could accuse you of anything, and it would go into the record, and you had no right of reply. You could bring a lawyer with you, but it implied guilt, and the lawyer could not cross-examine. There were no rules of examination, that is, you know, when, how, you know, to whom you can address a given question. There was absolutely no ties to anything legal in what they could say and what they didn't, you know, what they could not say and what they could ask and what they could not ask. Absolutely nothing. And if you did have the Fifth Amendment, but if you used it, it actually sort of, you know, it implies you're guilty of something, you know, because you're asking for it not, you know, not to be taken, not to incriminate you. And they had managed to put away 10 Hollywood writers and to put them in prison with these ridiculous accusations against them. I mean, people would come in and they would, you didn't have to have any proof. And it's important to bear in mind that the Communist Party was not illegal, and it was not illegal to be a communist. That is very, it seems to me, is very odd, and it is not something that I had known. I'd assumed that at least it was illegal to be one. But no, they were quite legal.
Wow. It's fascinating. And of course, so this committee then existed and set about with ferocious intention to ferret out anyone and everyone who might be communist sympathizers in some way seeking to undermine the well-being of the United States, perhaps even undermine our government and help bring it down. And one of the things you tell us is that in many respects, the theme of all of this was espionage, and yet espionage was a charge that was all but impossible to prove, and that in many cases, the way to actually get at somebody, even if they believed them to be guilty of espionage, was actually to go after them for, in a sense, a lesser offense.
Well, I think the thing that's important to bear in mind is that finding spies was the FBI's job, really, not HUAC's. And the FBI did arrest Judith Copeland, and they had a lot of evidence against her, and she got off, in fact. But I think the trouble is that the espionage charge is impossible to prove, or is very difficult to improve, although that was what they were getting her for. So what they did wasn't so much to charge you with something else. What they tried to get you to do, if you appeared on one of their lists, you almost lost your job at once. I mean, the 10 Hollywood writers were blacklisted for decades. It was a kind of a national hysteria. You can't, any association with one of these people was suspect. It made you suspect. There's this one poor man who had the same name as somebody they were going to call. And his neighbors were throwing stones at his windows. He wasn't even the one they were calling, but it ruined his life.
Hmm. Mr. Hiss appears before this committee willingly to try to answer the charge that that he was a communist. In a sense, his openness was part of what made it possible to lay a trap for him through what you kind of describe as a combination of events. And this, of course, is the heart and soul of the book, which we want people to explore on their own. But just give us the basic framework of what made it possible for someone innocent, as Alger Hiss was, to be brought down.
Well, I think this was a huge relationship between, this was Nixon's genius. Nixon really was, whatever you think of him, and I don't think highly, he was a genius, and he orchestrated this business. I mean, here you have the first hearing in which it's perfectly clear that Alger is innocent and there's nothing they can do, and he has fed the headlines to his newspaper people that he's about to crack the spy case. There is no spy case, but this is what's believed, that's what's handed out. With the increasing days, he made up news stories. He was, I think, 2 days later, he went to New York. It was all very secret, very hush-hush, because they were going to interview a secret witness, who was going to clarify everything and tell who was telling the truth. And they did fly to New York, and they did interview this mystery witness who turned out to be Chambers himself. No mystery. Hmm. So, but what was released was that the mystery witness had backed Chambers entirely. I mean, this is the kind of extraordinary thing. Of course, there's nobody now that was in that room that's still alive. The hearing is there, and it's an astonishing hearing because it has 2.5 hours missing. You know it's there, but nobody knows what went on during that 2.5 hours. Mm. And I mean, the setup was extraordinary. And over the weeks, more and more of these things would come out saying, Hiss had done this and Hiss had done that. And there was absolutely no basis for it. It was just made up. And I mean, you can see this from the hearings. You look at the hearings and you look at the headlines and you think to yourself, where did this come from?
Right. Exactly. And you say, especially when one very carefully reads the transcripts of exactly what was said and how it was said, and the way that things will be turned and twisted is absolutely astonishing. In fact, from one of the very first hearings, maybe it was the very first hearing, you tell us that even the way that Mr. Hiss took the oath, explain to our listeners this moment. It's one of just many examples in which reality was twisted for a devious end.
Well, this way, I mean, this is you get up and you say, "Do you swear to hell to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? So help you God." And Alger said, "Yes." And Stripling reported this as his saying, "Oh, by God, I do. Oh, yes, by God, I do," because it was believed that communists always exaggerated their Christian backgrounds and whatever they said. It was, again, this just extraordinary. And it's in his book, Red Threat Over America or some such thing. But this happened again and again and again. It's just impossible to bear in mind that, well, one thing, for example, is that Chambers, when they asked him, one first thing they asked him was if he could remember anything from Alger's house. And all he could remember was a red cigarette case. And this comes out in this the mystery witness hearing. And by the time it comes to the trials, he remembers everything. He remembers details of everything. And all he could remember was this one thing. Nixon tried to provoke him. What about their China? What's their China like? Can't remember. What about their glasses? Did they drink? No, they didn't drink. But then, of course, Alger did drink. And it was just astonishing when you can actually see these things and then see what's being said, claimed to have been said.
It says so much about the atmosphere at the time. I mean, one would hope that such a thing would not be possible without the hysteria that electrified the air. That was probably one thing, and perhaps Richard Nixon, so aware of that atmosphere, an atmosphere that he honestly helped to create.
Oh, he didn't.
He knew that he had a sense of what was possible, of how far to push, and of course, ultimately the result is Alger Hiss goes to prison. It's an extraordinary turn of events. And we've just scratched the surface in terms of all that you uncovered over the years in your research. As you began looking at this story, did you have any idea of how complex and fascinating a story this was going to be?
No, is the simple answer. I did not. I had no idea. I had no idea it was so... I also had no idea that it could possibly be so obvious. It's true, at the time, nobody could know, because all of these, the hearings were privileged and many of them were secret. They're now all out. I mean, and there were grand jury proceedings that were extremely secret. Those are now available. So people couldn't have known at the time. They couldn't have actually spotted all this stuff. But now it's perfectly open to anybody.
Mm. And you have told the story in such compelling fashion. The book, again, is Alger Hiss Framed, A New Look at the Case That Made Nixon Famous, published by Arcade Publishing, the author, Joan Brady. Joan Brady, I congratulate you on an absolutely fascinating book, and I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. This was a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Dr. Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology at Carthage College, will have a wide-ranging conversation about racism in America. And not just racism in its most extreme form, as we see in white supremacist groups, but the kind of racism that many of us might feel, although would be loath to admit. And we also talk about systemic racism. It's a good conversation. We recorded it a couple of days ago, and we'll share it tomorrow on the morning show. We also want to remind you that on Friday's morning show, I speak with Debbie Ford, who is the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Park.